the Strategic Defense Initiative Organization under the President George Bush, the chairman of the have ordered a number of people, and that is available with the link that is on Bernie's. The director of CIA is by himself talking about the EMP impact that might happen this month. At least I understood it this way. And the number of other sources says about preparation. FEMA is rapidly acquiring supplies. And from the statements of the other sources, they are also on Bernie's side. Someone who is a contractor working for a number of government projects says that the safest place would be in the basement of the brick house or the bunkers. And the director of CIA stands about vulnerability of our electrical system if that happened, that we might lose not only the internet but the electricity, but we also will lose plenty of other things. From the source I established, actually everything that is electronic might fail. Now, the addition to that is that a former president of CIA is pretty much fluent in Tesla technology, and he's talking about it. He talks about Thomas Edison. He's talking about the differences. He's talking about the vulnerability of our electrical system. And from other sources, there is a worries, and that's from the news, that North Korea may use that time, which is not a short period of time, it may extend to 6 years, to eventually take advantage of the United States. If somebody wants to find more about it, some information are pretty credible, some of them are kind of worrying, but definitely if it's going to happen this month, or this month is going to be the beginning of it, I would like to ask all of you what it is that you see from the floor of the solar flux. And to exchange back to Dick.
Okay, you created a fair amount of confusion here with, I think you're saying that somebody is predicting there's going to be an electromagnetic pulse EMP impact this month. Is that of solar origin? What's the origin of the EMP that I think you're saying a number of officials are concerned about? What's the origin? Why now? Has it ever happened before? Keep it a little bit simple here, Wes. WS2N, N2XJN, K2LIW.
Events might have happened due to the Cariton event. CARRINGTON, look at it. Event. The solar storm of 1859, known as the solar superstorm, was the first event that was also known as the Carrington effect event. And it was the powerful geomagnetic solar storm. Also in 50s and 60s, we have had a similar phenomena happen. I could go to those happenings, but June 2013, it was $100 million spent by our government to protect our electrical system for that event, at least what I found here. The joint venture from researchers of Lloyd in London and Atmospheric Environmental Research, AER, in the United States used data from Carrington effect to estimate the cause of similar disaster that might have happened, which would be $2.6 trillion. Now, the director of CIA talks about even bigger figure. The document with the director of CIA is only a few days old, so you might consider viewing that. And in 50s, I'm trying to find out where it was in 50s and 60s, but it happened before. Now what they say is, seeing my extension to up to 6 years. And the director of CSA for the fact that 2% of the population is growing food in U.S. And to HGN, back to Dick.
Okay, now, I'm having trouble figuring out what is the origin of a suspected EMP event that might take place this month. Is there something unique about this particular solar cycle? Like, the sun does reverse magnetic field on each 11-year solar cycle. I have been reading that the North Pole has already begun, the North Pole of the sun has already begun its magnetic field reversal. The sun... I think it's the South Pole that's trying to catch up. So is there something unique about this particular solar event that is making them think that the Currington event is about to repeat it? Is there something unique about this solar cycle and the portion of it that we're in that suggests that a unusual EMP event similar to what happened in the 1800s is going to happen again? Is that the nature of what this preparation is for, Wes, in 2XJN, KQLIW?
That is correct.
Okay, now, what is the raw ingredients that's setting them into this alarm situation? In other words, the particular waveform, so to speak, of this particular solar cycle is saying that we're possibly going to get a repeat of the Currington event. Is that what it is? Is there something unique about this particular solar cycle that's saying that, hey, maybe this is one of those big ones? Over to you, Wes.
What the director of TIA states is that the Earth barely missed a taking massive solar punch into the TIA of 2 weeks ago of the electromagnetic poles, so big that it could have knocked our power, cars, iPhones, and eventually create explosion of our nuclear stations. But I don't know if the wording about nuclear station comes from the director of CIA, because I didn't hear that, or this is the explanation that is underneath of it. Now, the world escape EMP catastrophe, said Henry Kapper, who leads strategic armed negotiation with the Soviet Union under the President Reagan. So we're talking about retired people who are right now in freedom of talking. And they have a panel. Okay, so also, what do you say, there has been a near miss about 2 weeks ago of Carrington class coronal mass ejection across the orbit of the Earth and basically just missed us, says Peter Vincent DePry, P-A-P-R-Y, who served on the Congressional EMP Threat Commission from 2001 to 2008. He was referring to the 1859 EMP name after astronomer Richard Carrington that melted telegraph lines in Europe and North America. So it was kind of known as event in 50s. And actually, it looks like NASA is taking pretty much consideration and calculation based on past events. The EMP effects are not rare. It occurred in Canada in 1989, knocking Quebec electric transmission system. North Korea is reported testing device to attack U.S. with the EMP attacks. The discussion about Canada and EMP taking place in Canada is pretty much often in all media, and there is a speculation that if that happened by director of CIA, if that happened in Washington, it would create a hundreds of billions of dollars losses just for the short
give us a great big burp periodically, a coronal mass ejection, where a whole lot of stuff at millions of miles an hour goes flying out from the sun in some particular direction into our solar system, high, low, left, right, whatever, and a high percentage of the time that CME cloud of stuff misses the Earth. Is there something unique about this portion of the sunspot cycle where somebody is predicting we're going to get a massive CME, and are they also predicting that it's going to just be directed at the Earth so that we're going to need to get an event like what happened in 1859 or 1989? Is someone predicting that there's something unique about this particular solar cycle that those previous rather destructive events to electrical systems, is someone predicting that they see evidence that it's about to happen again this particular year? And how firm is that evidence? I mean, to predict what the sun is going to do ahead of time, I suspect is very difficult, almost as bad as trying to predict when the next great big earthquake is going to take place. So what's making them think that all of this preparation is required at this time? In 2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Quick comment, Dick.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
First of all, that's ex-CIA director. All those people are ex. But it seems to be they're predicting it because it's a 200-year cycle. They think it goes to maximum every 200 years. That's, I think, the basis of that claim.
Elizabeth Moore. They've been on it. They've been seeing a step and progression, and they've been facing a certain document during the time they were having access to it. Now, what they say is, in the freedom of they have of saying whatever they want to, that it is happening and it is starting this month. Right now, actually, the prediction was on 11 of this month, which already passed. And it should extend to the period of 6 years. If the EMP strikes the electrical system, it might create a meltdown of the nuclear stations. For that, it may also affect the nuclear weaponry that is stored in the U.S. The most of the heat was traditionally, for the period of last 2 years, taken by Canada. But now it is affecting America. And Asia.
John, let me ask you this, though, John. What have you been reading? What journal, what articles have told you this kind of information? KC2WGB? K2LIW in the TechNet?
I took a cursory view of what Wesley had sent me. Plus, I went online and I was Googling certain things, and it seems that the melting of the telegraph lines happened in the 1800s, and that had to be a very heavy hit. And they said that if we were to get that hit today, what Wesley was referring to, it was from Washington, D.C. to maybe Maine. That would be the sort of the epic center. That would be a disaster we have never seen. Because don't forget, when the electric goes down, and it will be due to the transformers exploding, is what they're claiming, in most of the things I read, and those transformers are huge, can't even be transported on our highways because they would have to remove bridges and things like that. So they're trying to find a way to have these transformers located in reasonable areas, sort of what they wanted to do with Long Island and Loco. So that's all scattering reports here and there. But it seems that they think it's a 200-year cycle, and we did get a big hit that just missed us 2 weeks ago. Well, Wesley's right when it comes to that. But they don't forget, we don't have to have maximum solar activity to have these tremendous bursts. They can come at any time. They're more active during the solar cycle peak, but can happen at any time, Dick. Back to you.
Hey, Jay. Eric, recognized. get a very large amount of charged particles coming out of the sun, out of one of these coronal mass ejections. And those particles come flying at the Earth, and if it's a big enough cloud that it even punches right through our Van Allen belt, so to speak, and they hit the our ionosphere, and now all of your many miles of wiring, like what happened with the telegraph system in 1859, each one of those wires develops many thousands of volts of potential difference from the eastern end versus the western end, so to speak, and so that the voltage was arcing across the Morse code keys and doing phony excitation of those clickers and so on in 1859. Now, when that DC voltage creates all of that high current on our long distribution system, yes, the DC current flowing through a transformer at a power station saturates the transformer and does damage to it. I'd like to believe that our power stations these days are getting smart enough to know that when one of those events is about to occur or is occurring, they've got two choices. They can sit there and watch their great big transformer, which is very difficult to replace. They can watch it burn up, or they can simply drop offline. Yes, it's kind of sacred. Under very rare occasions do we intentionally interrupt our power grid. But if it's going to save your very difficult to replace, very large, very expensive power transformers for the distribution system, then it's time to go offline. Can we self-protect by going offline? Let's see what Eric's got to say on this one. KE2EJ, K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Actually, I don't have anything to say about it. I was just checking them out in Selden. I just wanted to make sure that everything's working.
Okay. I'm listening to myself coming back from Selden, and I'm hearing you coming back from Selden with no delay. So except for the fact that people listening to Selden are complaining that they're not hearing a beeper, let me take a quick look out there and see if I'm hearing a beeper.
No beep. I haven't turned it on yet.
Okay. Minor complaint about not hearing a beep. That's very minor. Other than that, I think you're in full operation. I think there is no time delay. So are you saying, Eric, that replacing that bad piece of cable has put you online, and is this for the first time we have full operation in a bi-direction of the RF link between the two repeaters? Is that about is that the favorable report we're about to get, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
That is correct. Now all I got to do is get a beep online with this, and we'll all set. But I'll do that from home. All right, go back to talking about magic things.
And I'm still hearing the 900, Eric, just to let you know.
Oh, by the way, I want to know if you can hear me when somebody else is talking. So,
1, 2, 3, 4.
When we were talking, I asked if you could hear me, and I don't know if you did.
We heard you in there for a split second, but not a full sentence.
Tell you what, John, why don't you talk for a minute, and I'll try and talk and see if somebody hears me.
Hello, 1, 2. I just talked on 900 while you were talking on, I think you're talking on 2585, and to my knowledge, I was not heard. Go ahead, Eric.
Okay. Then I have to change the settings in the Glen Oak side so that it'll pass through.
1, 2, 3, 4, did I come over?
K2J.
I know you did not. So you were saying 1, 2, 3, 4, John, and Eric dominated, and we did not hear you.
Okay.
Okay. Maybe I'll leave it this way. I mean, that way we won't get confused. But I was able to break in between the two of you guys real quick, and you heard me.
Yes, I'm trying to remember now. So I break in right now, Eric, while I'm talking, and see if I hear you. And I'm not hearing you right now. Yes, I think I heard your voice coming out of 375, but I'm listening on 85 right now while I'm talking. On 85, and I did not hear you on 85.
Okay, well, I can change that, but I think I'm going to leave it like this for now.
Yeah, it sounds like it's quite operational, and having the two machines linked in an RF manner as opposed to the latency of the internet is a very nice way to go. It's a good improvement on the system. So, do you believe the RF link is now running at the 99% level, or is it doing 90% of what you want? You're still going to do some tweaking. What do you think, Eric?
No, let's put it this way. This was an adventure because these radios actually VCOs directly on frequency. Having to modulate them because the radios don't go to the frequencies that these things are now on. Having to change the phase lock loop to allow the computer program that I wrote to put them on the frequencies that we're on now. Actually making the board and etching it and doing a little printed circuit thing and putting little microprocessors in there was kind of fun. And the only thing that we've got left is a little bit of stretch deck. Properly made. barge with any connector, I would rather have an airfuel connector outside because it's got three O-rings in it to keep everything on the outside on the outside.
Makes a lot of sense. Got to keep the weather out of connectors. You guys have heard me say a number of times that a couple of drops of water in the center of a Type N connector outdoors can give you more than 10 decibels of loss on 432. I've experienced that on a number of occasions. And I said to myself, well, I've got this kilowatt transmitter, I've got this connector where it's got some water in it, I'll boil the water out. I'll just run the transmitter key down 1,000 watts for 10 minutes and boil away the water. Great sounding theory on paper. Forget it. You then go and inspect that connector after you've done that water boil away procedure. And because of dissimilar metals or whatever between the center conductor and the shield and the ionized materials, the conducting materials in between under high power RF, you end up with a white pasty mess inside that connector. You've got a whole lot of insertion loss. You think you're going to boil away the water. In reality, you make a bunch of steam. The steam gets shoved down the foam of the cable, and you've got grief. If you want to remove the water from a connector, you've got to physically take the connector apart and physically take the water out. Don't even dream about thinking you're going to boil it away. I bet you've heard people try to boil it away in the past, and I bet you might also think that they were pretty naive. Have you run into things like that before, Eric? In your case, with high-power broadcast transmitters, I wonder if anyone thought that they're going to boil away the water. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2RW, K2EJ, what are you, out of your mind? You don't want water in there. That's why we have positive pressure inside those lines. Ain't nothing going to get in. Although, you do have the problem also. And you have melted Teflon and melted copper pipe. That kind of thing happens.
When's the last time you ran into one of those, Eric?
Now, let's see, it's 2000, I think it was, three sections of six-inch line failed and made an incredible mess, and that was 60 kilowatts doing that.
Was that in Plainview or Empire or World Trade? Physically, where did that take place? And my guess is that took quite a number of man hours and dollars to replace all that. Is that true?
It doesn't take long to replace it, but it does cost a lot of money. That happened in Plainview in 2000, and then in 2003, they lost a chunk of 3-inch line in Empire. That was another station. And then, let's see. Now that don't count. It's 2001 after September 11th, 2 weeks after all the TV stations went off the air, and they started coming up on Alpine. Somebody made a mistake and melted some 3-inch flexible helium.
In the case of the 2000 event in Plainview, where you melted down quite a bit of 6-inch diameter cable, if I understand you, being fed with 60 kilowatts, probably at 500 megahertz, what do you believe was the triggering event? What initiated that failure is your best guess, Eric. Go ahead.
Oh, probably defective fingers on the bullet, or not being put together exactly quite right. Probably the bolts weren't torqued properly. You know, even though it goes up the tower, there's movement, the actual pieces of coax or copper pipe or clothesline, whatever you want to call it, is held in place by springs, so the tower moves. The idea is that the hardline stays stationary until up at the top with a couple of joints there that will actually take a little bit of movement. But the whole idea is that things are supposed to be rigid, but, you know, also, age. You know, that stuff was put up in the 70s, so you can get failure loose inside the bullets themselves. There's a nut in the bolt that holds it together. If that loosens up, you're in big trouble.
In the high-power waveguide microwave systems I've worked on in the past, where they worried about an arc over being initiated, one of the protection mechanisms that has been used is a photo detector in the waveguide. I'm not sure if it's an ultraviolet detector or just an optical, but a photo detector in the waveguide detects the light that normally would be in this dark environment, and it says, aha, an arc over has taken over, and it puts the transmitter in a standby mode so you don't continue to make damage. In the case of your broadcast system, is there any kind of a similar detector that detects the fault so you're not continuing to pour 60 kilowatts into a fault and therefore create greater damage? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Something called a body current detector, which looks for flashovers within the metal housing, you know, the anodizing of the tube. Don't forget that it's run at minus 28,000 volts, not plus. What else is there? There's, that does all the protecting. It's battery to crowbar that kills all high voltage. There is, on the waveguide entrance, there's also another architecture, which is a series of photodiodes, but that's it. You know, anything past the, you know, pop up.
So if I understand you correctly, that some of your failure did occur beyond that point of detection. So therefore, in theory, you were pouring 60 kilowatts of power into a fault for some period of time, like maybe 5 minutes worth. Go ahead.
Heck no. I mean, you know, once the transmitter sees a weird visual, it shuts down. No, it only takes like 400 or 500 milliseconds to mount the 6-inch line. You know, you get off over for half a second, you've got plenty of damage. Now, that occurred about a third way up the tower.
Now, the detectors that were on a high power system that I worked on 10 or so years ago, 15 years ago, where it was a coaxial cable running very high power at near X-band frequencies, and if a fault like an arc over did occur, the arcing itself makes an extremely high temperature that melts anything in the area. Therefore, the arc slowly walks itself back to the traveling wave tube that was generating the high power. It slowly walks right through the vacuum seal of the traveling wave tube, and not until you lose the vacuum inside the traveling wave tube, which kills its ability to generate RF power, that's the only thing that really turns it off. I was trying to talk them into putting Viswa detectors, optical detectors, and whatever. The group of people, the managers I was working with at that time, let me drop them. They said, well, we've got an arc, and therefore we'll build a shield around that particular piece of cable. So they were building stronger and stronger shields to protect the rest of the electronics in the box and to make sure they didn't have a safety of flight issue where the arc could ignite a fuel vapor if there was in the area on this aircraft. So they were putting stronger and stronger shields around the cable itself and not worrying about detecting the RF failure, and they thought that would be protection. And I remember trying to convince them that, hey, that arc, once initiated, until you turn off that RF, no reasonable chunk of physics on planet Earth is going to stop that arc. It's going to eat up every chunk of metallic conductor you've got, and it's going to slowly walk itself right back to the source of the RF high power energy and eventually walk right through this $100,000 traveling wave tube. My goodness, but I had trouble convincing people of the physics of that situation. It's unfortunate that at times on a great big project you'll have supervisors who have the power to make decisions on chunks of physics that they understand about 5% of it. bet you've run into a little bit of that. I think in your industry it's not as bad as it sometimes is in mine. KE3EJ, K2RIW in the tech net.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Are these guys on demand? I mean, where are their brains? I make my transmitters shut down if they see a visual of more than 1.15 to 1.
Central America, it could shut most of the nation down from the pulse.
not the effects of the bomb, just the pulse. So they're trying to get these companies to get a plan together because there is nothing protecting the companies. They have minimal security. It's ridiculous. And they don't want to spend the money because everybody's complaining about electric bills. So this committee is looking toward impressing the public on what could happen, and they know it's going to happen. It's just a question of time. So they're trying to get some protection bill. That's really the whole idea of this conversation that this ex-CIA guy and a couple of other people had. And no, there's no definite positive reason why. It just seems that they want to stir the pot and get some protection going for us. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
And one more thing. The panel established that the amount of money spent for advising electrical technology and security together is less than America spent for advancing the technology of the dog food and to exhibit.
Yeah, I do see a lot of evidence that not enough disaster forewarning planning takes place. In the case of that great big blackout that we had, I think it was roughly 2003 in August, where a significant percentage of the east coast of the United States, the Northeast District, got all blacked out, and it was an event that got triggered in Ohio because a heavily used transmission line on a hot summer day was being fed a lot of current. The copper wire expanded because of the heat. It sagged down and touched a tree, and now you had something like 130 kilovolt line arcing over to a tree, and it wiped out that particular transmission line. That in turn cascaded all the way across the northeast of the United States, where as you develop more and more short circuits and everybody's portion of the grid tried pouring power into it, and they were exceeded and eventually suffered damage. Let me drop. If that particular event had been properly anticipated ahead of time, where somebody wrote themselves a fault chart where they said, if this occurs, you respond in this way. And maybe you set up computer programs to do that. Had they had proper planning, they would have realized that that particular high-power transmission line in Ohio had just experienced a fault. Had they dropped out that particular line and darkened that one single community, the rest of the system would have been protected. In reality, the whole rest of the grid tried pouring power into that short circuit, so to speak, and it just started cascading downrange. To have that poor forewarning and planning and not seeing it ahead of time, from my point of view, is pretty silly. I'd like to believe that when one of these EMP events occurs and you're starting to melt down your power transformers, that there's a thermal detector on the transformer before it hits the melted temperature, and rather than destroy something that's going to take you a month to replace, you drop it offline, and yes, you're going to black out a community, but that's a hell of a lot better than the alternative. Maybe I'm overly naive on here, on this particular one. Anybody got any further opinions on how to protect our power system? K2LIW in the TechNet.
BGB with a comment.
John, go ahead, John.
Old Dick, you have to realize another thing, too, which I'm sure you're aware of. Every community is tied into the grid. Now, whether they're drawing from the grid because they can't produce enough energy, or they're feeding the grid, this is the problem. If a feeder disconnects, okay, he can run his community, but now the grid is minus. And if you can't feed your own community when you pull off the line, you're going to go out. So there is so much that can happen. That's what they want to prepare for. There should be, just as you said, a plan. What do we do if this happens? Okay, in all cases, the best thing to do is pull off so that you don't suffer damage. But you may have to take power outage, and it may be for quite a few hours. So, you're right there. Back to you, Dick.
For the situation that is taking place over there, it looks like the reality for the martial law is pretty big one. So for any disaster of even short period, but great Wesley's magnitude happened, the Marshall Law is going to be applied.
True in all cases, yes.
So as I see, and again, in that August 2003 massive blackout, which was one of the biggest ones we've ever had, had that been properly anticipated, and you drop out, that you disconnect that one particular community in Ohio and let them go dark, and let that power system feeding that particular faulted transmission line become disconnected, it saved the rest of the system. I'm amazed that somebody hasn't seen that ahead of time. I mean, we had a massive blackout in roughly 1965. We had another great burn in 1968 or 69. We had the great big massive blackout in 2003. And each one of these, if you do a lessons learned analysis, to me it is relatively obvious that certain things have to be sacrificed. If this, this, and this happens, then that particular community has to be dropped offline and sacrificed in order to save the rest of the system. You do the most good for the most number of people simultaneously when you sacrifice a small group of community. And I'd like to believe, let me drop it.
Yeah, that's triage, Dick.
It's a kind of triage, and I'd like to believe that your vital services have uninterruptible standby power. A number of your vital cell sites have standby power generation. Many hospitals have standby power. Many fire departments have standby power, so that when the grid goes down, they're still on the air. So to drop out a community's source of general power in order to save the rest of a quarter of the United States, isn't that overly obvious? How in the world, what I think you're saying, John, is that right now there isn't a psychological interconnect. There isn't a society, a protection society, grouping together the individual power generating companies so that they've worked out that plan. Is that sort of where the problem lies? Everybody is independent. KC2WGB, KQLIW in the TechNet.
Absolutely, Dick. They are all independent, even though they are co-related and tied into the same grid, which shouldn't be. Now, here on Staten Island, we do have a generating plant that can supply Staten Island, but we also have Brooklyn involved with that. So when we have an energy, when it went out in, I forget what year it was, Staten Island had electric, but they had to drop Brooklyn. So yeah, triage is going to happen, and that's why we had electric when everybody was out. It was a very good thing that they did. And they only did it by, I think, 30 or 40 seconds they were able to do that. But yeah, they got to coordinate and understand that certain areas, all right, Manhattan is very important, they have to maintain power. But if having Manhattan run is going to bring down the rest of New York, it's got to go. I agree. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, one more comment is that they're afraid about 2% of the population growing food for the rest of the population. So if that happened, it's not only martial law they foresee, but the tanks on the streets, mass arrests and shootouts for the protesters. And to actually...
John, that situation where Staten Island with its local power generation was on the air and you guys had to drop out Brooklyn, I presume there's some kind of a grid arrangement between Staten Island and Brooklyn, that if Brooklyn is shy on its transmit power, they borrow some from Staten Island. Did that occur? Are you describing the event of August 2003? Is that when Staten Island stayed on the air and the rest of the area went dark? KC2WGB, KQRIW.
No, Dick, it was after the 65 event. We lost power in 65. Let me see. No, it may have been the 65 event where we maintained power, but everybody else around us was dark. It happened in one instant only. And, we are attached to the grid through high wires, they call them, which go to Jersey. And that goes to the Tennessee Valley, not Niagara.
is into Staten Island, and we have our generator running, and we supplement several boroughs under the water. And the only way we can keep Staten Island running, if we don't have that grid connected, is to drop the other boroughs.
So your local power generation capability, which is probably Con Ed on Staten Island, has more than enough kilowatt capability to, as long as you disconnect the surrounding boroughs, if I understand correctly, you have more than enough energy capability to keep all of Staten Island on the air. Is that true, Eric? John?
Yes, that's the way it was in 65 up till at least 1970. We built a lot of construction here, but I think we can still power up most of Staten Island. I don't think we would have a problem with that. But however, they're gas-driven, natural gas, so we have to have gas supply to be able to do it. It used to be a coal plant. They changed over to gas. So when you talk about standby generators, sure, like all the hospitals have it, some of the power production facilities have standby generators, which can help them augment power. But the fuel supply to them has to be continuous. That's something else they haven't straightened out. We're going to have martial law if it goes out. Farming, forget about those 2% people. If we don't have power, they're not going to have water and all of the other things they need for farming. So there's just not going to be any food. So these are things you can't really stress about. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, we've got about less than 1 minute left before we get cut off. What you guys listened to is TechNet number 1463 of the series that began in September 1982, 30 and a half years ago. Boy, these guys are enthusiastic, and they keep doing it. 73-year-old, bye-bye for now. One quick question I got for you, Eric. One quick question I got for you, John. Is all of the power generating in Staten Island all in one single power?
The western edge of Staten Island.
So in other words, one facility. So it isn't a group of individual power stations. One single facility is capable of keeping all of Staten Island in the air, one Con Ed facility. Is that true, Eric? I mean, here we go, John. Okay, I hear you. 73-year-old, bye-bye for now. See you guys next week. KQRIW clear.
Okay, Dick. Have fun. Be safe.
What did you say, Eric?
No, I just called John. I want to see if this is still going. You can't hear me, or you can't hear me?
I'm
hearing you beautifully, Eric.
All right, am I coming out of 85?
You're coming out of both machines.
Okay, did the 85 shut itself down?
Roger, Dodger. 85 shut itself down, but I'm hearing you coming out of 85.
Okay, that's good. All right, and all of a sudden now I'm getting beeped. Which is really funny.
That machine has a mind of its own, Eric.
This machine has a what?
I'm saying your machine has a mind of its own. It's teaching you to be humble.
Yeah, well, I'd make it recycle itself at midnight, so... Oh, well. There we go. The audio sounds really good at this end.
Yes, it does. It looks to me like our RF-coupled audio is a lot nicer than internet-coupled audio.
Yeah, but these receivers only have half the deviation, and they roll off frequency-wise a little more than the 5 kilohertz machine does.
So are you telling me that these are industrial-grade narrowband receivers that you're using right now?
Yep, they are. And I only let the deviation peak at about 2.3 kilohertz.
And although you get you get decreased audio out of the receiver at the far end, you readjusted the amount of coupling into the repeater, and therefore the audio is normal level.
That's correct. The only thing is, I don't think these things really, well, my ears couldn't tell me. I don't know how much high frequency is coming out of this stuff. I know the low end rolls off a little bit hotter. I think it starts at around 200 hertz, something like that. Honestly, it'll pass, I think it passes like 80 for the CL tone, but it's actually got a separate circuit for that. Yeah, when I listen to you out of at the eastern output, we've got full audio. When I listen to you out of the western output, the low frequency notes are a little bit attenuated. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, what we do is we pre-emphasize the PL so that it'll pass.
Makes sense. Okay. Looks like all of your efforts for the last couple of days has finally paid off. Last couple of days. You've been working on this for over a month, haven't you, Eric?
Well, it started out I had to modify the radio to go to the frequency that we use. The commercial world is actually split. It's 45 megahertz between transmit and receive. And the VCOs of them don't want to go where I want them to go.
That makes sense. I'm amazed that there's a 45 meg separation in this particular frequency region. I'm getting the impression that you took things from some other frequency region and moved them to this frequency region, because this region, I don't think, uses 45 megs of offset.
Yeah, well, the same frequencies of the commercial stuff is from 850 to 901 or 902. No, 901. And the transmit frequency started at 930.
Understand. The actual piece of equipment doing the transmitting and receiving right now, how big is it? Is it a quarter of a cubic foot and 10 pounds?
I don't know if you've ever seen a GE Master 2. It's the same form factor. It's in the same kind of case. So it's six rack units big.
Understand. Okay. Looks like we're getting there, Eric. Out of curiosity, you've now got IRLP, you've got Echo Link, you've got RF linking. What's next, out of curiosity?
Right, well, actually, I had to shut down the Echo Link. I had left the Echo Link running for about 2 hours this evening, and then booted everybody off and told them to go to the W2LIE site so they could listen. IRLP is fully functional. Actually, now the IRLP node itself is independently dial-inable and dial-outable. So, that's interesting. The next thing is I got in here with the controller and add a few more ports to it. The controller only got 3 ports and I need more than that, so I already put a board together. I just got to finish this and hook it up, and then the Echo Link will be back online. And then after that, I've got a PHF Master 2, and I'm in the process of moving it up to 220. So I can get rid of the Honda junk that we used at 220, and I got a nice amplifier for that. And then after that, well, actually before that, I'm going to drop. I've got on Wednesday, before Wednesday, I have to put in a translator, and we pick up an outdoor cabinet to put on top of the hospital and replace that hissy, noisy 30-year-old translator that goes from 2.5 to a UHF frequency to get into the voting system. So that's got to get done. And then we got 2 more voting sites to put together, and that has to get done. What else? I'm going to put a voting receiver on the 375 to try and close the gap between where 85 gets by and you can't get into 375. So I want to make it so you can get into 375 when you hit Nassau County. You know, cover that area.
That's obviously going to be pretty busy. What happened that made you have to drop the Echo Link people tonight, Eric? Go ahead.
Well, I'm using the voice that I normally use for Echo Link. To me,